This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice. Excuse me. Pardon me. Believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. That's something you're never supposed to do. I have got so much dust in my lungs from South Sudan, I'll tell you. I am back. I am back, and boy, you go to places like we were in the... on the edge of the Darfur region, depending on who you ask, as Ellen Ratner will probably tell us today, we had a long conversation. She was saying, well, we were actually in Darfur, but it's a semantic difference. So we were within 15 miles of the border there and where the refugees were coming in. And it's amazing stories. We met with Salva Kiir, the president of South Sudan and the vice president of the country, for about an hour or so. And we'll have audio and we'll have pictures and all this stuff together and on the website sometime over the next week or so. It's going to take a little bit of time to integrate and gather all this stuff together. And there's some audio over at talkradionews.com right now if you want to check it out. But it was extraordinary. The rebels, the terrorists in the south, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, fought this war, this 25-year war, with the north, with the government of Khartoum. And the people in the south, mostly black Africans, the people in the north, mostly Arabs, and the black Africans, mostly animists and Christians, although in the Darfur region, they're Muslims as well. And those in the north, the Arabs, were largely Muslim. And there's all these, there is no simple, let's boil it down to this. I mean, if there was anything that I got out of this trip, there is no simple, let's boil it down to this. And, you know, it's not black against brown or Arabs against Africans or Muslims against Christians. There's no simple boil it down to this. But just consider that we slept for three nights. We were there 4 days. Went in with this aid group, Christian Solidarity International, which is one of the few NGOs that's actually doing work in that region still. And although there are several others, and you know they're a good bunch. Some things I love about what they're doing. Some things I arguably could disagree with. But they are at least doing this work. We went in with John and Gunnar, who have made like 80 or 90 trips into the region. They started going in during the war. They've been bombed. They've had planes that they thought were going to come out of the sky. I mean, it was just incredible. In fact, we flew in we flew on a commercial airline, East African Airways, from Nairobi to Juba, which is in the south part of Sudan, and it's sort of a UN town. And from there, we flew to Gok Machar, which is within 15, 20 miles of the Darfur border, and a town that during the civil war had been attacked and looted and burned. And I talked with one of the locals, and I said, what's your biggest concern? And he said, every day we're afraid, you know, that the army is going to come again and that they're just going to destroy everything. It was during the dry season. There's a dry season and a rainy season, and so there's these basically the only vegetation. I mean, you'll see like acres of just clay and dust. I mean, like desert, just clay and dust, and punctuated by these giant trees old mahogany trees and things, just giant trees because their roots can reach deep down in under the surface to pull up the water, and then. And then the communities spring up around these, and these little huts and whatnot. And one of the reasons, and we went to on the second day, we went to another community, and I literally just my plane arrived. It is right now as I am speaking. It is 10 minutes after 9 in the morning Pacific time, And we've been in here doing show prep since about 6, and I arrived home at 1:30 this morning. So I haven't had time to organize all my notes and everything. But we visited this one other city that, or one other, well, it was a little town. By town, I mean, this is a country the size of Texas, larger than Texas, that has 10 kilometers of paved road. And so you can, there was no electricity, there was no, I mean, we were in Gulf Machar, where we were staying, 45,000 people, they have one well. They have no doctor. We saw people with, there was one kid whose leg was severely infected. There was a girl that we saw who had a hole in her leg that was probably 2 inches long and a half inch thick right down to the bone. The CSI folks had brought a doctor with them, and he actually was seeing some of these people. This is how we got to see some of this. But this is, they basically, what this community has is one well, which was drilled by the UN a couple of years ago, or either the UN or one of the NGOs, they weren't sure. And this woman, Monica, who is the commissioner, she's in charge of the region. She's actually been given this authority by the government of the South. The South fought this 25-year, essentially civil war, and fought the North to a stalemate. And Salva Kiir, who we spent an hour or so with, was one of the commanders of the along with John Garang, who was really the hero. He's sort of the George Washington of South Sudan, but he was just a few weeks after he was succeeded and was inducted as vice president of the country, he was killed in a helicopter crash. And Salva Kiir, we met, giant, imposing man, 6'5", with this giant black hat and in Juba. And that's the government, basically, and it's for the South. And Monica, this woman who is the commissioner of the town, the community that we were in, in the state of Pathral Ghazal, and in Awail North County, which is right up on right there on the border with Darfur. And she took us around and showed us around, and she was, you know, her concern was they had no school, they had no hospital, they had no, you know, they had no doctor, they had very often no food. They, you know, people were sleeping out in the open. There was the area. This is the epicenter of malaria in the world right now. They're, because the refugee populations are coming through. The refugees are the most fragile of people, and the day that we left, the morning that we left, that night, a couple hundred people had been repatriated from the north. The government in Khartoum in 1999 or 2000 had acknowledged that, you know, slavery was going on up there, and drew up this list of 8,000 people that they're going to repatriate, and 135 of them showed up in Gok Machar that morning. And so Monica, who had spent 3 days with us kind of showing us around, we're here with these refugees. I mean, the little kids with swollen bellies and yellow hair, you know, the kwashiorkor and the severe malnutrition and flies everywhere and open sores and wounds and God only knows. And there's this old, old man whose fingers were just gnarled and his feet looked like elephant leather. I mean, just, you know, he had been worked almost to death. He had been a cattle herder at work as essentially a slave for somebody up in the north. This old man is in this group of refugees, and Monica takes us to this group of refugees, and this old man sees her, and he says, "Monica?" And she looks at him, and she says, who are you? And he, this is in their language, I have the audio of this. I'll be pulling this stuff together for you over the next couple of days as well, and we'll get it on our website. And he's like, "Are you Monica?" And he names her, and last name and everything. And she's like, "Yeah, that's me." And he says, "I am your father's brother. You don't remember me?" And she says, "No, I don't." And he starts telling her stories about when she was 5, 6, 7 years old, and she just breaks into tears. Her family, about, you know, her father died of natural causes. Many of her father's brothers and the rest of her family, many of them had died in the war, in the Civil War. She was the lone survivor of her family. And this man was her uncle, who had been taken as a slave during the war about 20 years earlier when she was a child. And she was reunited with him right there, right in front of us. And we were all just, you know, bawling and just blown away. But anyhow, I got to tell you about this other town we went to, and we'll take your calls also at 866-303-2270. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media. 3 hours a day. 5 days a week.
Tom Hartman here with you. When we were on the sat phones at one point, I said, you know, there's some things I just, you know, don't want to say about where we are and what we're doing. That was the day we went to Majakar, which is this other community right up against the near the Darfur border. And that community, just 5 days or 6 days before we got there, had been completely evacuated because the word was that the North Sudanese army and perhaps some of the paramilitaries, sometimes referred to as the Janjaweed, which has become a kind of catch-all phrase. But in any case, were on their way. They were going to come in and burn the village to the ground and kill everybody. And then they didn't, you know, it didn't happen. And so people came back. And that community had a number of people from the north coming back, repatriated. And so we went down to that community in the back of a dump truck. And, I mean, literally, we stood in the back of the dump truck with all this, on the way back, actually in the empty dump truck, we stood on the way back, and these long, rutted, bouncy roads, just wild. It was a wild ride under the equatorial sun. It's just unbelievable. And the dust everywhere. You know, passed out these sacks of hope is what they call this thing, the CSI, to these returning refugees. But Jack Rice is one of the guys that was with us. He's also a talk show host in Minneapolis, but he works also with the Talk Radio News Service with Ellen Ratner. And he used to work with the CIA. And Jack was, after a couple of hours, after we had passed out some of the stuff, and we were sitting there and we heard this whap, 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 whap in the background. And he was like, uh-oh, you know, are they coming? And that was our concern constantly. It turned out that what it was somebody nearby running a grain mill, grinding some of the grain that we had brought in. But it sounded like a helicopter at first. And Jack actually filed this report for the Talk Radio News Service. He's, you know, one of the guys who was with us on the trip. Rusty Humphreys, a conservative talk show host, was also there on the trip with me. And, but here's a report that Jack filed. You can find this over at the talkradionews.com website, just a short report.
This is Jack Rice for Talk Radio News Service. I just sat down with a 20-year-old woman named Atwat Gwat Dot. And Atwat is a 20-year-old slave. Well, she was a slave until about 2 days ago. You look at her life, she doesn't remember her family. She doesn't know where she's from because she was taken when she was so young. She was brutally raped over and over and over for years by anywhere from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people at a time. Through her very difficult life, she has seen multiple people murdered. She was converted to Islam. She was forced through all sorts of horrible things that were done to her. What's amazing about this is as you talk to this woman, you can still see the spirit in her eyes. She seems broken to some degree. But you can tell you can't survive this, but for some sort of secret spirit that you continue to hold on to. As I talked to her, as she held the baby in her arms, it seemed that maybe she was fighting for that child. I'm not sure, to be honest. But what I do know is that for those people in the world who think that slavery is a historical anomaly, they need to look into the face of a twat. you need to look into the face of the 150 people sitting in front of me who were slayed 3 days ago. Because when you do that, you sit down and you realize that the world is not what you think it is, especially not in a place like Warthog, Sudan. This is Jack Rice for Talk Radio News Service.
And that Jack recorded that just about 3 hours before we left. And, you know, we all left together, and like I said, I just returned home at 1:30 this morning. And this is the situation. The situation there is grim, and the eyes of the world really need to be brought onto Sudan, and there, for a couple of reasons. There's an election coming up, and the election in and of itself probably is not going to be a flashpoint, although who knows. But in 2011, because right now there's this Comprehensive Peace Agreement, the CPA, that is basically the resolution of this civil war that happened. But in 2011, there's going to be a vote on whether or not to divide the country into two nations. And everybody's preparing for war, everybody that we talk to. And, again, this was stuff that I didn't want to talk about on the satellite phone while I was there. But we were seeing it everywhere, that people are preparing for war. And the expectation is that if the South chooses to secede from the North, then we're going to see something that's going to make Darfur look like a cakewalk, like an absolute cakewalk. Because during the last civil war, several million people were killed. But just Joe Madison was with us also. Joe was on our show last Friday, African-American talk show host out of Washington, D.C., and on XM. And who just a great guy. In fact, his wife Sherry had come along. This was Joe's, I think, fifth or sixth or whatever. He's been to the region a number of times. In fact, he had been there back when the Civil War was going on, and in an area that was being bombed when he was there. And Joe made the comment. He said, if there was a town of 45,000 people in Belgium with only one well and no electricity and no phones and no stores, and no food, don't you think it would be a worldwide news event? Well, here we are, you know, with this in Africa, and it's not a worldwide news event. It should be.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour, and welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. There's a lot of things happening in the world. A lot happened while I was gone. For a couple of days, we had very little news, although Ellen Ratner was keeping track with the sat phone. But Barack Obama's response to Pastor Wright's remarks, absolutely stunning. Absolutely stunning. And this may be, I mean, people are talking about this as like, you know, the Gettysburg Address kind of speech, Barack Obama.
For we have a choice in this country. We can accept a politics that breeds division and conflict and cynicism. We can tackle race only as spectacle, as we did in the OJ trial, or in the wake of tragedy, as we did in the aftermath of Katrina, or as fodder for the nightly news. We can play Reverend Wright's sermons on every channel, every day, and talk about them from now until the election, and make the only question in this campaign whether or not the American people think that I somehow believe or sympathize with his most offensive words.
And obviously that's the spin that Fox News has been putting on it. And in fact, we were even in Africa, we were hearing the Fox News spin, you know.
We can pounce on some gaffe by a Hillary supporter as evidence that she's playing the race card. Or we can speculate on whether white men will all flock to John McCain in the general election, regardless of his policies. We can do that. But if we do, I can tell you that in the next election, we'll be talking about some other distraction. And then another one. And then another one. And nothing will change.
In fact, throughout Africa, particularly in Kenya, I mean, taxi drivers would ask me, what's going on with Barack Obama? And they say, we check the news, the American election news every day. Anyhow, he continues.
That is one option. Or, at this moment, in this election, we can come together and say, not this time. This time we want to talk about the crumbling schools that are stealing the future of black children and white children and Asian children and Hispanic children and Native American children. This time we want to reject the cynicism that tells us that these kids can't learn, that those kids who don't look like us are somebody else's problem. The children of America are not those kids. They are our kids, and we will not let them fall behind in the 21st century economy. Not this time. This time we want to talk about how the lines in the emergency room are filled with whites and blacks and Hispanics who do not have health care, who don't have the power on their own to overcome the special interests in Washington, but who can take them on if we do it together.
There you go. That's just, you know, a small piece, a small fragment of an amazing speech. And it's the fifth anniversary of George W. Bush and his George's extraordinary adventure. You'll recall George always wanted to do this adventure, as Cindy Sheehan testified before Congress, before John Conyers Commission. Mickey Herskowitz, George Bush's biographer, who his family hired. Bush told him the story about how if he got elected, he wasn't going to make the mistake his daddy made. His daddy had a war with Saddam Hussein that only lasted 100 hours. Well, now we've got a war that's going to last 100 years, according to John McCain.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote. It looks like George Bush was ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president.
Yeah. And on the fifth anniversary here, what does Cheney do? He goes fishing in Oman. Very interesting. And of course, George Bush on this.
First, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
Liar. There's no other word for it. Liar. We know that before he became president, he intended to use the invasion of Iraq for purely political purposes. He became president. He did so. And here we have this mess. So a lot going on. Barack Obama giving a brilliant speech, the fifth anniversary of the Iraq invasion. In our next hour, by the way, Kathleen Kelly is going to come and tell us about the liberals in the corner office and how dangerous we all are. Larry Scott will drop by in our third hour to give us an update on what's going on with VA programs. But by and large, throughout the day, be taking your calls, talking about the news of the day and what's going on. 1-866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And Stephen in Vancouver, Canada. Hey, Stephen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Good, thank you. Tom, I've spent 24 years in Africa, so I'm quite familiar with the continent. And I've done a lot of charity and aid work there. And unfortunately, at the end of it, I came to the very sad conclusion that there is really nothing that the West can do to change things in Africa. And most of the aid and good work that is done there suffers from the law of unintended consequences. Africa has lived in a state of perpetual conflict for probably 100,000 years, and I don't see it changing anytime soon.
Let me challenge a couple of those assertions. First of all,
sure.
I don't totally disagree with you. The first time that I went into Africa was in 1980 into Uganda during the war with Idi Amin, when Amin was being thrown out by the Tanzanians. And we started a program in Mbale. You can find it, information about it over at saliminternational.org. In Mbale, originally it was, you know, just a feeding station. I mean, we had thousands of literally starving to death people. And then it became a hospital, and then it became an AIDS hospital, and then it became a, you know, organizing widows and AIDS widows and orphans and things. And it's gone through a lot of morphs and transformations over the years. And I agree with you that to a certain extent, just tossing aid at people is not the solution. On the other hand, what we have in Africa right now, I would challenge the assertion that for 100,000 years there's been conflict. Certainly there has been conflict there, but there has also, I mean, you read some of the ethnographies of, for example, the San is probably one of the most well-documented. You know, even just the movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy, is actually a marvelous look at the San, and I encourage people to go out and rent it. There were many people, many communities that lived just as with Aboriginal communities, Native American communities in North and South America, other parts of the world in Asia, that lived in peace, that you know, were relatively harmonious, that life wasn't all that bad. And then the British came and the French came and all the colonial powers came in, and they carved it all up and they started sucking all the resources out. And then in 56, in the case of Uganda and Sudan, and I can only speak for those two countries, having been to both of them, having been to Uganda many times and Sudan this last trip, in 56, when Churchill said, okay, that's it, we're out of here, you know, bowing to world pressure, left a huge power vacuum and a lousy example of governance.
Well, you know, Tom, that's the old excuse that everything's blamed on colonialism. Now, I would agree with you that the San is a peaceful tribe. I've been with the San personally, and they are the exception in Africa. And Africa has hundreds of different sort of ethnic groups as well, and they all have their own tribal ways and unique cultures. Now, however, the San, shortly before the arrival of the whites, was largely exterminated by a more aggressive black tribe in southern Africa. And the more aggressive tribe that had largely exterminated the San was more of a typical African tribe, as I was saying, in a state of conflict. Now, when you talk about things like...
Stephen, we could have the same conversation about Europe 1,000 years ago.
Well,
could we not?
Yeah.
Oh, look at the
possibly,
French. The French came in, in 1099, you know, the Battle of Hastings. That doesn't mean that you just throw up your hands and walk away.
Well, I've invested a lot of blood and sweat in that country. I've got friends and family buried there, and I've seen everything that I've built turn to dust. I mean, you look at, you say colonialism is evil, and yes, it was. It had evil things about it. However, under colonialism was the only time that those countries actually thrived. There was starvation. They were building railways. You could make the point that the people were subjected, and they were, and that's the bad side, but colonialism ended slavery in a lot of those countries, you know, brought technology. And when the colonists left, sorry, I'm outside, it's a bit cold, so my voice is a bit rushed. When the colonialists left, things have deteriorated.
So what's the solution, Stephen, in your mind? What should we do?
I'm sorry?
What's the solution? What should we? I'm sorry, we only have 30 seconds before we've got to take a break.
The solution, I think, is to just let them sort it out for themselves. When I was there, I've seen aid come in. It comes off a truck. It goes out the airport, the warlords hijack it, and that feeds these conflicts. They use food as a weapon. They use it to buy more guns and soldiers and bullets, and it just fuels it. You know,
I have control. Seen that in some regions, and I've also seen aid work in some regions.
Well, it works.
Like I said, I mean,
people have to. The other problem with it is you give them aid, then they throw all their farming implements away, and they want aid next year, and they don't farm.
Yeah, well, that's why in this case, thank you, Stephen. I've got to wrap this up. That's why in this case, what this organization was bringing in was, I mean, we were passing out to people hoes that you can use to cultivate the ground, fish hooks for the rainy season to fish with, basically, you know, tarps and things to live under, the essential tools to rebuild your life. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Fire it up, fire it up. We push up, we're rolling boulders, crashing down the mirrored stairways to a blast best mind.
The Tom Hartman Program. Brought to you by you, our listeners. Listener-supported radio. Support you, supporting our sponsors, particularly the local sponsors on your local radio station, our national sponsors. And SEIU 1199, 200,000 health and hospital workers fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And let me just say, while I found, and I have found over my life, that you know, when you have a crisis, if you can do triage over the short term, it's a good thing. Like we helped rebuild Europe and Japan after World War II, for example. And certainly triage is necessary in Africa. As our last caller pointed out, or perhaps the subtext of what he didn't say it, but I'll say it. The really important thing is that infrastructure and institutions of civil governance actually be pulled together and work. And this is where the eyes of the world need to be on Sudan. The eyes of the world need to be on what's going on there, because they have now discovered oil in the south, and the deal with the north is that after the south had this 25-year civil war with the north, ultimately they came to this comprehensive peace agreement a couple of years ago. And what came out of that is that 50% of the oil revenue from the south goes to the north, 100% of the oil revenue from the north goes to the north, and the north has been paying the south for their oil revenue and not saying, oh, here, by the way, let us give you an accounting of this. They're trying to bring the Norwegians in to broker this thing. But that's the point. Involving the international community in a way that helps build infrastructure. Just tossing food at people can create, ultimately, over the long term, more problems than gain. But if you can build infrastructure, building schools, building hospitals, helping people put together governance, systems of governance, you can have systems that really and truly work. Steve in Monterey, California. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I called about Darfur, but that last caller got my Irish up, reflecting that if Dublin managed to take control of the Belfast shipyards, then the British world imperialist, you know, system would have a whole different, you know, dynamic to it.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding Darfur, one of your tapes was referring to a potential civil war.
Yeah.
And
well, I was talking about it. I'm very concerned that Sudan is going to devolve into civil war in the next couple of years as a consequence of all this oil that's been found in the south. And frankly, the one legislative thing that could be done in America about this is we have an embargo on Sudan, and
including their oil.
Exactly. But the embargo does not extend to the south. South Sudan, those I think it's either 10 or 13 counties. South Sudan, it's legal for America to trade with except oil. And because we've exempted the oil, the Chinese are coming in and they're buying all this oil.
That's what I called about.
Yeah, and I think that I would like to see legislation introduced into Congress that says that we are going to lift the embargo on oil coming out of South Sudan so that you know there can be some development there and the resources can be their own. Now, again, the law of unintended consequences, it's not inconceivable that doing that could, again, precipitate a civil war. It has to be done with the world community's eyes wide open and a hell of a lot of publicity.
Right, right. Well, my question, like, I understand the Chinese have been helping construct the pipeline. Does that pipeline lie in Darfur or Sudan?
No, to the best of my knowledge, there's not oil in Darfur. Darfur, what happened was when the South Sudanese rose up against the North Sudanese and said, you know, we're not, and this was before oil was discovered, frankly. This was back in the 70s. And they rose up and they said, we're not going to be dominated by you. We're a separate area. And the north was principally Arab and the south was principally black African and a variety of different tribes, mostly animist and some Christian, and started the civil war. And they succeeded. And then the black African Muslims in Darfur said, hey, we'd like independence, too. And that's when the North started crushing Darfur, and that's when the world started paying attention.
Right,
So now there's oil, but most of the oil is in the South. Some of the oil is in the North. And if the South, this is the deal. If the South could negotiate their own oil agreements with even American oil companies, for example, and I find it's very odd for me to be talking like this, but
right.
Then they could build pipelines through Kenya to Mombasa and and they wouldn't be dependent on Khartoum on the north.
So if Halliburton didn't have their head up their butt, then they'd be in there competing with the Chinese, right?
That's right. And actually, oddly or strangely, I mean, not necessarily Halliburton, but it would probably be more like, you know, the British Petroleum and the Norwegian oil companies and Shell Oil, the Royal Dutch, and Chevron and ExxonMobil and whatnot. And it would diminish the power of China in the region. And make it more of a world issue, and I think that might be a useful thing. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. It's very interesting. John in the Bay Area in California. Hey, John.
That last caller stole some of my points. I wanted to respond to that first caller that called in and talk about Doug Ford. That first caller, with his accent, you can't lump them all in one group, but I knew he was going to say a lot of negative things. A lot of these guys, the Boers or some of these South Africans that were mad that apartheid fell, and there's a whole disinformation campaign by a lot of these people to say that Africa is just this place that, oh, nothing can be done, and this nonsensical comment about 100,000 years, this and that. But you set him straight on a lot of points. Africa suffers for a couple of points of that it's been divided up, and a lot of powers have plans for this continent to be turned into just a resource.
Yeah.
It is
one of the John. Sorry, we're out of time. The machine starts here, and it's the news at the top of the hour. But you're right, and in fact, you know, you couldn't, your computer wouldn't work if it wasn't for Africa. I mean, a lot of the rare earth minerals that we use all over the world to make things come right from that continent.
The Tom Hartman Program, for your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity. Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. Here we are, the fifth anniversary of this marvelous Republican war in Iraq. Now, actually, the war has been long over. It was quite a successful war. Knocked down Saddam Hussein, overthrew his government, but well into the occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq. And the 30 years now of Reaganomics seems to be working out just fine. A few people at Bear Stearns a little concerned, but much of the middle class. But nonetheless, we wouldn't want to go back to those nasty liberal policies of the New Deal, would we? Or liberals like Dwight Eisenhower. Kathleen Kelly is with us. She's the author of a new book, Help! There's a liberal in the corner office! A conservative guide to the Everybody Gets a Ribbon liberalization in corporate America. Kathleen, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am fine and very pleased to have you with us. Your book, you know, lampoons political correctness, and I think perhaps appropriately so in many cases. I found one of the interesting anecdotes here, your story about the person who was using the N-word and your response to that.
Yeah, that was a really interesting event that happened in a rather large company where there was an African-American employee that was on my team. And she, you know, obviously had a bit of a history of being provocative and saying provocative things. And she walked up to a group of other employees that were busy doing their job and just kind of it began to address them openly using the N-word and openly just saying it for shock value. And there was a young white male in the group of people busy doing their work, and he was a bit taken aback by it. As he brought it to the attention of superiors, his point I thought was quite valid. He said, you know, if that was me using that term, greeting fellow employees that way, he said, I would have been, you know, on my fanny out the door within 10 seconds. And
well, actually, in your book, you say it was you who did it. You said, my first stop was the head of human relations. Well, I got laughed at. In fact,
I did.
HR... Yeah,
I
so,
did.
So you intervened in this. And then you said you made another stop to my lead where no one, where lead no one, no.
No leader.
No, yeah. And suddenly it sounds to me like you're a liberal here. You're looking out for folks. I mean, what am I missing?
This is a challenge. challenge with the political correctness in the environment. And while I absolutely have to agree with the one employee who was offended by the use of the term, regardless of who it was directed at, I was more surprised that the human resources lead basically said, oh, that's just nothing. Don't worry about it. You know, you're just being dramatic. And my point was that if it had been a white employee using that term as opposed to an African-American employee, it would be handled much, much differently. And I, you know, categorically as an executive vice president was alarmed that, you know, as an officer of the company, that, you know, I'm certainly alarmed about it. This person worked for me, and that the rest of my leadership just kind of said, nah, you know. And it's not necessarily an ideological issue of being Republican or liberal, but more so the fact that this is what political correctness, and what I talk about through the book is just how much it has overtaken what is, to, you know, always considered to be true and valuable in business, and that is, you know, achieving of
So do you think that there should be laws against, for example, workplace discrimination or harassment? I mean, I would consider the use of the N-word or other, you know, or very vulgar or sexist language harassment. Do you think that there should be laws against that? That it should be possible to actually, you know, fire an employee and say, you know, sorry, you can't do that?
But there are protections against discrimination in the workplace that are already in place.
Well, that's my question. Do you agree with those?
I think unlike a lot of other black and white issues that appear in the law, it's unfortunately up to the barometer of the listener as to whether or not they're offended. That's one of the things that that I explore quite frequently in the book. Is
so you don't think that you don't think there should be laws against abusive language in the workplace?
Well, I think, again, I think it depends on the work environment. I think it's incumbent upon the tone in which it was delivered and the way it happens. We're at a point now in the corporate environment where you really can't say anything. It's also about how you're dressed when you say it. It's also obviously largely dependent on who your boss is and how your boss feels about this and the company and the special interest groups that are part of that particular company. This was a very, very...
But corporations are essentially kingdoms. You know, corporations are not democratic institutions. Governments obviously are responsive, at least at some level, to the voters because they have to go before them every couple of years. Corporations are...
I have to disagree with that, though, because I think in many cases, many corporate environments are becoming almost too democratic, where they cannot make a decision, they cannot, you know, go in a certain direction without everybody, you know...
Well, that's not democratic, that's bureaucratic. You know,
well, I'll give you that one. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and you know, the bureaucracy of these giant corporations is something that I told, you know, I used to work in that or with that world. I was CEO of an ad agency for a number of years, and many of my clients were Fortune 500 companies, and it was just amazing. I mean, people talk about government bureaucracy. I frankly find that there's a lot of corporate bureaucracy out there that's far worse than any government bureaucracy I've ever seen, and I've seen some pretty bad government bureaucracy. But still, that's not democracy. My point is that because corporations are organized like kingdoms, and they literally are, I mean, they literally use the old model of kingdoms where you've got the kings and then you've got, you know, the CEO and then you've got the lords, you know, the basically the middle management, and then you've got the serfs. You've got all the worker bees, and the worker bees essentially don't even have the rights that are protected under the Constitution. You don't have the right to privacy. The lords and the kings can monitor your email. They can listen in on every phone call you make. They can, you know, even overhear your conversation in the bathroom. There was a case litigated about that. They can go after you for things you say outside the workplace. You lose your First Amendment rights of free speech. You lose your Fourth Amendment rights of privacy. You lose your Fifth Amendment right to testify against yourself. And yet. I guess we could leave it at that. And yet the corporation itself as an entity claims all those rights. We have tobacco companies that for 40 years and asbestos companies, what killed my father as an asbestos company, they knew in the 1920s, 1930s that their products were killing people. And they used the Fourth and Fifth Amendment to say, well, we're a person as a corporation, and so we don't have to disclose to the government, to we the people, to all Americans what we know. Isn't there something fundamentally wrong with that?
Well, I think it's interesting because, you and I are probably pretty close enough in age that, you and I obviously remember a time when I think that was certainly true in most cases of businesses and most importantly of corporate entities. I can tell you that the major corporations, and there's some very big names that I have, whether it fortunately or unfortunately in my dossier, that are actually run very, very different, where the employees are given so much protection, so much entitlement, and more rights, and frankly, complete freedom from being held accountable for anything, that it becomes more and more difficult as a people leader to be able to get the work done, to be able to hold them accountable. You can't hold employees accountable anymore. You have to give them so much entitlement. These kids coming out of college that are, 18, 19, 20, 22 years old now are the ones that cause me the most concern.
Yeah, but what I'm talking about is things like the Fox RGBH case down in Florida, where Jane Aker and Steve Wilson, husband and wife news team working for a Fox television station down there, did a report on this recombinant bovine growth hormone and that was in the milk in the community. And they found that it had some problems. And over 30 different times, at management's request, they edited the story until it reached the point that management was actually asking them to lie on the air and say, this stuff is safe, nothing to worry about. And at that point, they quit. They filed a wrongful lawsuit, a wrongful firing lawsuit, which I think you would say is, some liberal thing to do. And the jury of their peers unanimously upheld the firing and said, this is wrong. Fox then appealed that to an appeals court. And in a 2-3 decision, the appeals court, the two Republicans appointees on the appeals court said, no, this corporation has the right to force their employees to lie because it's a person, too, and it has the First Amendment right to lie, and it has the right to force its employees to lie. I mean, that's the state of corporate America now. Isn't that much worse than, political correctness in the workplace?
Well, you're talking about an independent issue and an independent case. Being part of these corporate environments, this is what's going on is the entitlement problem.
Yeah.
That's what the book talks about.
Okay, well, people can check it out. Kathleen Kelly is the author of the book, Help! There's a Liberal in the Corner Office. And there's actually some pretty thought-provoking stuff in here. Kathleen, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Even if your hands are shaking and your faith is broken, even as the eyes are closing, do it with a heart wide open. Say what you need to say. Say what you need to say. Say what you need to say. Say what you need to say.
21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The most labor-friendly show in all of radiodom, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Interesting, this whole issue of, there's liberals in the corporations and because they've gotten so big. And why have they gotten so big and why have they gotten so bureaucratic? Well, because Ronnie Reagan stopped enforcing that Sherman Antitrust Act, that nasty law that just said, it's okay to have a business. In fact, it's a good thing to have a business. As Teddy Roosevelt said, the small business person is the backbone of America and the medium-sized business person is very good, but big business has to be watched carefully. Good old Teddy Roosevelt. And so in 1881, they passed this law that said that when corporations conspire to monopolize markets and things like that, so that's what's happened. And now we have the result of 30 years now of Reaganomics. And it's been an absolute disaster. Michael Flaherty in Reuters from Hong Kong. This was in the International Herald Tribune. Read it on the plane at midnight last night on my flight home. Dateline Hong Kong. One group conspicuously absent from a last-minute deal to scoop up Bear Stearns. This is an investment company that survived the Great Depression. But it's not surviving the Bush Depression. One group conspicuously absent from a last-minute deal to scoop up Bear Stearns on the cheap were the sovereign wealth funds that have spent billions of dollars on Wall Street lately. This is bad news for Western companies or any other firm hit by the credit crunch that is tightening its grip on the United States and Europe. He goes on to say, as the funds and foreign investors stay away, there could be little comfort for Wall Street workers hoping a foreign investor will help them keep their jobs. There's no way anybody's going to catch a falling knife, said Craig Russell, chief market strategist in Beijing at Zaxo Bank. Why come in now? Since November, Citigroup has raised about $30 billion in capital from Abu Dhabi, Kuwait, and Prince Awaleed of Saudi Arabia. But it looks now like everybody is starting to back off. China, for example, bought into the Blackstone Group. Remember that big deal? The private equity group? They've seen their stake cut in half. Stocks are going down. International Herald Tribune, just looking at the cover of it, I mean, this is the result of 30 years of conservative economic policies. In the 1920s, in the early 1920s, after Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat, won World War I, you know, the Republicans used to say, yeah, the Democrats are the war party. World War I, World War II, terrible thing. Except they won those wars. Anyhow, after Woodrow Wilson left office, there was a series of Republican presidencies. And in the early 1920s, which led directly, obviously, to the Republican Great Depression of 1929. And in 1920, 21, there was I forget which year it was. It was either 20 or 21. Five consecutive massive tax cuts for the very wealthy in the United States and for corporations. And, again, loosening of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And trusts started to form and combinations started to form. And this is what Franklin Roosevelt talked about. This is what he was so upset about. And then the Republican Great Depression happened. And Franklin Roosevelt came along and said, you know, what we need to do is we need to regulate the banking industry. We, the people, need to have some say in how the economy works and is run. We're not going to micromanage the thing. We're not talking communism here. We're not talking about, you know, like the Soviet Union 5-year plan, stuff like that. But there have to be appropriate limits. Otherwise, the predators will get in there and do their thing, which is what we've been seeing now with these subprime mortgages. So just looking at the headlines from yesterday's International Herald Tribune, Rich Miller, is the Fed running out of options in the credit crisis? Ben Bernanke may be facing something worse than the loss of personal credibility on Wall Street and in Washington, waning public faith in the Fed's ability to turn around the economy and economy and financial markets anytime soon. Fed has been playing the equivalent of whack-a-mole. Here's another headline. Rescue by Fed hurts confidence of banks. Here's another one. Bear Stearns staff is stunned by sale. The sale of Bear Stearns to J.P. Morgan Chase stunned the staff of the Wall Street Bank and pummeled financial stocks Monday amid fears. Blah, blah, blah. Of course, now there's apparently a stockholder revolt going on. Dateline Frankfurt. This was actually the top headline. Top headline. Yesterday's International Herald Tribune. Eroding confidence stings banks. Volatile markets and worried policymakers on Monday offered the clearest evidence yet that the month-long financial crisis linked to the U.S. mortgage market has turned into an acute crisis of confidence in the global banking system. Thank you, Ronald Reagan, for all that deregulation. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program. Back from South Sudan. And I just, if nothing else, if nothing else, educate yourself about what's going on there. Educate yourself about what's going on in this conflict between North and South Sudan. As time goes on over the next week or so, we'll have photos, we'll have some audio up, we'll have, you know, more information on our website and other places. But and I'll be telling you some more stories about it as time goes on. But it was just an extraordinary, extraordinary trip. In the meantime, there's strange news out there, as often there is. This is a long and unusual German love story. There was this boat shaped like a swan, you see. And Petra, a black swan, fell in love with the boat. So now the zoo director has hooked Petra up finally with a real swan and returned the boat to its local owner because it was becoming a problem. They couldn't take the boat out without the swan getting very possessive. You know, fortunately, well, actually, you know, it's mating season here for the geese anyway, here in Portland, Oregon, and for lots of things, actually, I suppose. We're seeing the geese and the ducks in particular in the river. And Gusellini is back. He was back on our back deck. In fact, I played some honking for you last week. So, anyway, it's strange things. I want to just contrast two speeches, and then we'll pick up your calls at 866-303-2270. First of all, this, of course, the fifth anniversary of the Bush invasion of Iraq and subsequent occupation.
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
Yeah, these UAVs targeting the United States. It was a balsa wood airplane that was a toy owned by Uday Hussein. Or maybe it was Kudai, whichever. One of Saddam's sons had a toy airplane. And George Bush told us that they were going to be able to drop biological weapons on the United States. Incredible. Now, to contrast that,
a lack of economic opportunity among black men and the shame and frustration that came from not being able to provide for one's family contributed to the erosion of black families, a problem that welfare policies for many years may have worsened, and the lack of basic services in so many urban black neighborhoods, parks for kids to play in, police walking the beat, regular garbage pickup, building code enforcement, all helped create a cycle of violence, blight, and neglect that continues to haunt us. This is the reality in which Reverend Wright and other African Americans of his generation grew up.
You know, and in some ways, what Barack Obama was talking about in that speech echoes the whole conversation we had in the last hour about what's happening in Africa and other underdeveloped parts of the world or problematic parts of the world, arguably even, you know, any post-war area. But certainly areas where liberals, where people who believe in civil governance, people who believe that government can actually help us achieve our highest potential, are not the empowered, shall we say.
They came of age in the late 50s and early 60s, a time when segregation was still the law of the land and opportunity was systematically constricted. What's remarkable is not how many failed in the face of discrimination, but how many men and women overcame the odds, how many were able to make a way out of no way for those like me who would come after them. But for all those who scratched and clawed their way to get a piece of the American dream, there were many who didn't make it. Those who were ultimately defeated in one way or another by discrimination. That legacy of defeat was passed on to future generations. Those young men and increasingly young women who we see standing on street corners or languishing in our prisons without hope or prospects for the future. Even for those blacks who did make it, questions of race and racism continue to define their worldview in fundamental ways. For the men and women of Reverend Wright's generation, the memories of humiliation and doubt and fear have not gone away, nor is the anger and the bitterness of those years. That anger may not get expressed in public, in front of white coworkers or white friends, but it does find voice in the barber shop or the beauty shop or around the kitchen table. At times, that anger is exploited by politicians to gin up votes along racial lines or to make up for a politician's own failings. And occasionally, it finds voice in the church on Sunday morning, in the pulpit, and in the pews. The fact that so many people are surprised to hear that anger in some of Reverend Wright's sermons simply reminds us of the old truism that the most segregated hour of American life occurs on Sunday morning.
Fascinating. Absolutely brilliant speech by Barack Obama. A gift to us. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Art in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Art, what's up?
Tom, get back to health as quickly as possible.
Yeah, thank you. I got this cold just about the time I was leaving, and it's been whacking me ever since. But thank you for your well wishes.
Listen, the right-wing media are downplaying the significance of this magnificent speech. So what I'd like to do is to hark back to the book by Gore Vidal, Lincoln, where he lists three of the comments that was made about the Gettysburg Address.
Okay.
One is from the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania Patriot and Union. Short quote, "We pass over the silly remarks of the president. For the credit of the Union, for the credit of the nation, we're willing that the veil of oblivion shall be dropped over them and that they shall no more be repeated or thought of." The Chicago Times, "The cheek of every American must tingle with shame as he reads the silly, flat, and dishwatery remarks of the man who has to be pointed out as the President of the United States."
Yeah.
And then the
Gettysburg Address.
Here's the nasty one. In England, the London Times said, "The ceremony was rendered ludicrous by some of the sallies of that poor President Lincoln. Anything more dull and commonplace, it would not be easy to produce," end quote. Now, that was the Gettysburg Address, which we all learn in our schools. And yet, at least three newspapers sought to minimize and downplay the significance of this magnificent address.
Yeah, excellent point, Art, and I appreciate your calling and sharing it with us. That it is... And it's amazing. I was out of the country. I was flying. It took about 30 hours to fly home. We had to fly from this town, Gok Machar, and strapped into the back of the cargo plane, into the belly of the cargo plane. Actually, they came back and said, "You're a pilot, right?" And I said, "Yeah." And, "Oh, you can go sit up front." And so I sat in the jump seat between the pilot and the co-pilot through most of the flight from Gok Machar to Lokichoki. It was one of these white planes with no markings because it was essentially an illegal flight or a chartered flight. And we flew into Lokichoki into Kenya. And then from there, we picked up a East African Airlines flight to Nairobi and then from there to Zurich and then on home. Anyhow, long, long trip all the way back. And I forgot where I was going with that. This is what happens when you're trying to do radio on 2.5 hours of sleep. And yeah, let's go back to the phone calls here. Freddie in Seattle. Hey, Freddie. Freddie? No, Freddie. Len in New York City. Hey, Len, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Welcome home.
Thank you.
Totally overlooked over all the other news going on with Obama was McCain. I mean, it's been picked up, but really not to the extent it should be, is McCain's repeated misstatements about al-Qaeda. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, Louise was telling me about this, that Joe Lieberman had to keep whispering over his shoulder, "John, you got it wrong, you just had a senior moment," kind of thing.
And apparently the day before also, he was on the phone with talk show guy Hugh Hewitt,
mm-hmm.
and saying the same thing, that al-Qaeda is going into Iran to be trained to come back out.
Right, and he doesn't realize that al-Qaeda is a Sunni thing and Iran is a Shia country and it's just like the people who don't... Go ahead.
This is basic evidence. This is something that we should completely grasp onto. This is similar to that Gerald Ford moment when he didn't know Poland was under the influence of the Soviet Union, or the time when Bush said, you know, we can't really win the war, you know, against terrorism. You can't really win it, which was totally, you know, not used at the time. But this is something that just is, this is the guy who's supposed to be our foreign policy expert in this race.
Right.
And he, all he's interested in is fight. It's all them. He doesn't understand anything that's going on there. And this is something that we really have to grasp onto as the best evidence that he really can't be able to sit down and help these people work the, work it out because he doesn't even know who they are.
Right. No, and now we've got Dick Cheney here, this from Oman, the Associated Press, this Dateline Oman, retaining his tough stance against, and thank you for the call, against Iran. Vice President Dick Cheney said Wednesday that Tehran may have restarted the nuclear weaponization program that a U.S. intelligence report said was halted in 2003. Oh, boy. Here we go again. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com. We'll be right back.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'll be rolling down a hill like a snowball headed for hell. With no kind of chance for the flag or the liberty bell. I wish a Ford and a Chevy would still last 10 years like they should. The best of the free life behind us now. The good time's really over for good.
No, I don't think so. I really don't think so. We can bring it back. Ellen Ratter's with us live from, where are you, Ellen?
I am in Dubai.
In Dubai with the Talk Radio News Service. So they, even with all the visa pages in your passport wiped out, they let you in.
Well, actually, she came in Greece, and I said, use this one, and she kind of looked at me, but she did.
Well, good. I know you were quite
concerned. I knew that I was going to get Greece. But I got to tell you, Dan Patterson and I had complete shell shock. Imagine going from, as you know, probably the worst places on this planet to probably the richest city on this planet in 24 hours.
Yeah. Whiplash.
When, you know, it's interesting, you had the music, we can, and you said, you know, we can bring it back. And after I look at Dubai, and I look at what they're doing, now granted, you know, there's a lot of question about how they pay wages and workers and all that kind of stuff, but you look at the buildings they're building, and you look at the television here, and you see what is happening, Tom, in the United States, and you say, what did we do the last 20 years or so? We have not built our country.
Well, you know, 30 years of Reaganomics has been, you know, we've ignored our infrastructure, we've ignored our schools, we've ignored our commons, basically. And what Dubai is doing is they're building their commons.
Absolutely, they're building their commons. And when you see the riches in Dubai, which frankly was just shocking from coming from where I came from with you, but then when you come here and you watch the television here and you see what's going on in the United States and you say, and Dubai is thinking of getting rid of the dollar standard and going to the euros, you know, unless we do something drastic, it's over. The United States is going to be like Britain was after, you know, the wars, and Britain still to some degree is.
Well, or it might be like Argentina was after, you know, after the shock therapy of the 80s and the early 90s, whenever that was. But yeah, it's we're on a bad edge. What news would you like to share with us, or would you like to give us your thoughts on our mutual trip to South Sudan? And Carl said that you had said earlier this morning that we were actually in Darfur.
Yes, apparently John Ebner said that we actually were in Darfur. Now there's a dispute of the borders. The North claims it as theirs and says it's part of Darfur, and the South says, well, no, it isn't.
It's part of South Sudan.
But the North does believe that where we were in that Sunday and actually the Saturday was actually in Darfur, and I think they didn't want to say anything to us because of we were broadcasting.
Yeah, and the possibility that if we said something on the air that a plane might come and drop a bomb on our heads.
That's exactly correct.
Yeah, it was interesting, and that's why I've been saying
we would have never seen those Arab grazing, et cetera, that we saw, and a lot of what we saw with the returnees if it was just southern Sudan.
Yeah, you're right. So what's going on in the world, Ellen? Your talkradionews.com report?
Well, you know, it's interesting here. I mean, I've been following the Washington News, but I'd like to give you a little bit of Dubai perspective because McCain's statements that, you know, Jerusalem was going to be the capital and all the stuff that he said has been front and center over here. And people are just in shock.
What did McCain say that was so shocking?
I believe he said that Jerusalem should be the capital of Israel, which, of course, every presidential candidate has, you know, said not done to them, that they haven't all said it. But McCain essentially went over there and rattled some more swords, and the president started talking about Iran. And
well, I understand the president talking about Iran. What's wrong with saying that that Jerusalem should be the capital of Israel? I mean, isn't it?
Well, but the problem is that, as you know, the capital and all of the embassies and all that are in Tel Aviv. When you talk about Jerusalem,
right.
I'm sorry?
I said you're right. I had totally forgotten all the subtleties of that aspect of Israeli politics.
Right. People here are bananas. And people in the newspapers, radio, on the television, and Iran saber rattling. And in fact, I have a picture, which when my internet here is not very fast, but I have a picture that of the Iranian bank here. It's this huge modern building. And, you know, we're talking about, and they're their next door neighbor, and we're talking about rattling more swords around, and it's just not going to fly. No wonder they're going to move off the dollar standard.
Yeah. And when they move off
the
dollar
standard. And I don't think it's just economics, honestly. I also think it has something to do with our politics.
Yeah. Yeah. And if we move off the dollar, if much of the Middle Eastern world, the Arab world, moves off the dollar standard, the OPEC world in particular, we've got a major problem.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Huge problem, and it's coming, and everybody sees it. We're the only one. We're an ostrich. We don't see it.
Well, this is why gold's over $100 a barrel, and why, or over $1,000 an ounce, and gold's over $100 a barrel. It's not that the price of gold and oil are going up; it's that the dollar's collapsing. Yeah, you could buy a suit for an ounce of gold, and back in 100 years ago, and you can buy a suit for an ounce of gold now. I mean, it's commodities are the same. It seems the dollar is what's falling apart.
Exactly.
Okay, great talking with you, Ellen. Sounds like you need some sleep.
I do. Thank you.
A long day. Thank you so much for the report. And give my best to Dan, and I look forward to seeing you back or talking to you soon back here in the United States. Ellen Ratner, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Program. Welcome to the vast radical middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
3 days, 10 hours, 45 minutes, 38 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office, barring impeachment. Yep. It is the 5th anniversary. A lot going on. The 5th anniversary, and so let's take a look at what the status is of the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance. There are people on the fire.
total, this is from the Department of Defense website. The total military casualties, military fatalities, 3,990 U.S., 175 United Kingdom, 133 from other countries. On top of that, 20,416 wounded with no medical air transport required, 8,904 requiring wounded with medical air transport required, non-hostile transports was 31,000, non-hostile related medical air transports, 31,325, non-hostile injuries, 8,273, diseases of the medical, et cetera, 23,000, medical air transports, 40,000, this is a total, casualties, not deaths, of 132,199, which, of course, does not include the estimated somewhere between 50 and 100,000 with post-traumatic stress disorder and other long-term problems, and missing or captured. I mean, Ronald Reagan basically won a presidential election based on the fact that there were U.S. hostages in the Middle East. We still have four servicemen who are missing and captured, are being apparently held hostage in Iraq. Staff Sergeant Kenneth Maupin, taken on 16 April 2004. Ahmed Kusai El-Tayelt, status, missing captured, 23 October 2006. Specialist Alex R. Jimenez, status, missing captured, 12 May 2007. And Private Byron W. Fouty, status, missing captured, 12 May 2007. Let's keep them in our prayers and best wishes. And just think about the criminals, frankly, who lied us into this war. Who lied us into this thing right from the get-go. 3,990 American troops dead. Some estimates as high as a million Iraqis dead. 4.5 million Iraqis displaced. 2 million internally. 2 million, 2.5 million externally to the country. This is behind the disaster that's happening in Sudan and Darfur. This is the second worst refugee crisis in the world now in Iraq. 60,000 of our troops subjected to so-called stop-loss measures, which is a fancy way of saying, hey, you thought you signed up for just 4 years or 2 years or whatever it was. That's absolutely incredible. This is the anniversary of Bush, you know, well, on the one hand...
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing.
What did Iraq have to do with what? The attack on the World Trade Center? Nothing. Let me just play that again for you, just in case you didn't hear it.
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing.
Yeah, and so then he gives a speech where he goes into this whole long rant about the dangers of Iraq, right, and what they present to
Iraq us. Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons. If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year.
Now, at the time, they knew that those aluminum tubes were for rocket engines, not for centrifuges, A. And B, the second point was purely rhetorical. You could say the same thing about your next-door neighbor. Anybody who can get that kind of plutonium can do that if they have the resources. And it was a lie. It was just a lie. And so then in the speech, Bush says, Bush who later said, what does Iraq have to do with 9/11? Nothing. But later in the speech leading us to the invasion, he said,
we've experienced the horror of September the 11th. We have seen that those who hate America are willing to crash airplanes into buildings full of innocent people. Our enemies would be no less willing. In fact, they would be eager to use biological or chemical or a nuclear weapon.
And he wraps this whole thing up with the specter of...
facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
And now the question of the day. For the third time in 2 days, this is Sam Stein writing over at the Huffington Post. For the third time in 2 days, the Arizona Republican has pushed the definitively false statement, speaking obviously of John McCain, that the terrorist group Al-Qaeda was getting assistance from Iran, even though he was publicly ridiculed for the same false assertion on Tuesday. And this time in his campaign honoring the fifth-year anniversary of the war, McCain wrote, again, this is Sam Stein putting this, but this, here are McCain's words. Today in Iraq, America and our allies stand on the precipice of winning a major victory against radical Islamic extremism. Now, let me just insert my commentary here. There was no radical Islamic extremism in Iraq before we invaded. There had never been a suicide bombing in the 7,000-year history of Iraq. Saddam Hussein ran a secular state. Al-Qaeda was his enemy. It was a secular state. Anyhow, John McCain continues, the security gains over the past year have been dramatic and undeniable. Al-Qaeda and Shia extremists, with support from external powers such as Iran, are on the run but not defeated. Say what? He said it again on Tuesday. Joe Lieberman had to lean over and whisper in his ear that it was Shiite extremists, not the Sunni Al-Qaeda, that were going to the predominantly Shiite Iran. But he keeps doing it. He keeps doing this. So Barack Obama says today, McCain's constant misstatements prove that he doesn't have the foreign policy experience or the understanding or the judgment. He doesn't even really understand the, quote, terrorist threat or understand the Iraq policy. As Obama said, just yesterday we heard Senator McCain confuse Sunni and Shiite, Iran and Al-Qaeda. Maybe this is why he voted to go to a war with a country that had no Al-Qaeda ties. Maybe this is why he completely fails to understand that the war in Iraq has done more to embolden America's enemies than any strategic choice we have made in decades. Amen. Amen. And Barack Obama, again, this absolutely brilliant speech that he made.
In fact, a similar anger exists within segments of the white community. Most working and middle-class white Americans don't feel that they've been particularly privileged by their race. Their experience is the immigrant experience. As far as they're concerned, no one handed them anything. They built it from scratch. They've worked hard all their lives, many times only to see their jobs shipped overseas or their pensions dumped after a lifetime of labor. They're anxious about their futures. And they feel their dreams slipping away. And in an era of stagnant wages and global competition, opportunity comes to be seen as a zero-sum game in which your dreams come at my expense. Anger over welfare and affirmative action helped forge the Reagan coalition. Politicians routinely exploited fears of crime for their own electoral ends. Talk show hosts and conservative commentators built entire careers unmasking bogus claims of racism while dismissing legitimate discussions of racial injustice and inequality as mere political correctness or reverse racism.
This is one of the most brilliant speeches I've heard in my life, and absolutely extraordinary. And I'll share a little bit more of that segment of it, you know, after the break. We've got a break coming up here in just a few seconds. And now is such a time, both in the United States and all over the world, for the need for statesmen or stateswomen, for people, Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, as the case may be, to step up and say, okay, enough of the petty politics, enough of the gotcha stuff. Let's rise above it. Let's make this nation great. And let's bring peace to this world. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Nothing to test it all. They got all the answers wrong. No plan.
are these, what do they call them? Republicans? Conservatives?
I don't think they're true to either title, frankly. Republican Party, Abraham Lincoln's party, he must be rolling over in his grave. Barry Goldwater, Everett Dirksen, principled men in many regards, must be just horrified. Larry Scott's with us, the chief cook and bottle washer over at VAWatchdog.org, one of the largest and finest veterans websites in all of creation, or at least in all of this planet.
In the known universe.
In the known universe. There you go. VAWatchdog.org. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm running on 3 hours of sleep, and after five flights in 30 hours, I'm okay.
Yeah, other than that, you're doing just fine. Well, as you were talking about earlier and running off some statistics a little earlier in the hour, we do have the fifth anniversary of the war. But some of those statistics you were giving seem a little low to me.
Okay, go for it.
Okay, well, let's look at...
I'm just using the stuff off the DOD website, but...
Wow, the Department of Defense, have they ever been known to maybe skimp on some of these numbers? Let's take a look at just a few of the statistics. 1.7 million service members have cycled through Iraq and Afghanistan. 800,000 of those are now considered veterans, are out of the service, and qualify for health care. Now, you talked about it, just a few tens of thousands of who were injured.
Mm-hmm.
Right. 300,000 service members from Iraq and Afghanistan have sought and received treatment at the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA.
Wow.
300,000.
So what accounts for the disparity? Are they just giving numbers of actual, like, you know, injuries that that receive triage at that particular moment in Iraq or something?
They're looking at the wounded and the injured that happened right on the field of battle. They're not looking at the people who are shipped out to Germany and then end up back in the United States and have to receive either military or if they get out of the service, and then VA treatment. And you look at other things, too. Let's say a guy is injured. He falls off his truck. Maybe his leg gets run over, and, that leg is damaged somehow. That's not going to show up as an injury on a DOD report. But he comes back to the States, he gets out, and he realizes there's been some permanent damage to that leg. He ends up getting out of the service, going to the VA. He receives treatment. He may receive disability for life. This is one of the costs of war we don't consider. You know, the DOD gives us those very small numbers and says, well, these are the wounded. But these are not the injured. What we have to look at is not only who's been wounded, but who's been injured and the long-term costs of those care. Now, of those 300,000, Tom, 40% have been diagnosed with mental health issues. More than half of those have a firm diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. That's about 20% of those 300,000 troops. So that's at least 60,000 people so far with the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, something that will be with them for life. That number of 300,000 is expected to rise to 700,000 troops working their way into the VA healthcare system in the next few years.
And
this has all been covered by Stiglitz and Billmes in their wonderful article that I'm sure you've seen, The $3 Trillion War.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And
do you have a link off of VAWatchdog.org to that?
I do someplace. I'll have to dig it out and put it back on the homepage again.
Okay. Good.
Because it's to the point now, the article's been out so long, it's almost considered old news.
Yeah, that's the stuff that really needs to be out there. And that, of course, is just the American casualties. The Iraqis are human beings also.
And, that's true.
And the majority of the victims of this war have been civilians.
Yes, and we don't look at that. A lot of the guys from Vietnam, some of the Agent Orange lawsuits have been going forward, and we see the problems with Agent Orange. A lot of the Vietnam veterans will tell you, you know, I am so concerned about what happened to me and my buddies, but look what we did to the Vietnamese people as well.
Yeah.
The tragedy of Agent Orange in that country and the millions of people with birth defects and
right.
the pollution that's left
and,
in that country,
yeah,
we
this,
don't consider.
And this generation's Agent Orange is called depleted uranium.
Yeah, and we don't even know where that one's going to go yet. We have no concept of what the problems could be with depleted uranium down the road. We need more studies. More studies are being done. But let me put it, and I think it's safe to say here, Tom, not enough studies on depleted uranium are being done by the DOD. Right now, do you know how many troops are being studied face-to-face by the Department of Defense for exposure to depleted uranium in the first Gulf War?
I do not.
70.
And this is from the first Gulf War.
70, right. From 1991, There are 70 veterans who they know were exposed to depleted uranium. So they have isolated them, and they are studying them over a long period of time to see if any difficulties arise. Basically, they're ignoring whole other bodies of evidence and looking at just these 70 troops and saying, well, if nothing bad pops up, then we don't have a problem, do we? So again, going in with eyes closed and looking for an answer that has already been predetermined.
Yeah, that's the Bush administration in a nutshell. And tragically, Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website, wonderful site, great resources for veterans and for anybody who cares about veterans, which should be all of us, frankly. Larry, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Get some sleep.
Eventually I will. Thanks, Larry. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You can talk to me. Talk to me. When you're down now, you can talk to me.
Well, you can talk to us at 866-303-2270. The Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. By the way, on March 28th, I'll be doing my show live from the KMPT studios in Missoula, Montana, and giving a talk at 2 p.m. at the Holiday Inn Parkside at 200 South Patty Street in Missoula. The talk is free, and I'll also be signing copies of my books. Scheduled guests that day will include Montana's Governor Brian Schweitzer and Senator John Tester. And the visit is sponsored by KMPT Radio, the bookstore at the University of Montana, and Four Seasons Subaru in Missoula. Isn't that cool? See, there you go. Support your local sponsors. Support your local companies. And you are thereby supporting Progressive Talk Radio. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Oh, I just have to share this with you. I mean, this is a McCain alert. This is our new McCain theme song, I think. From the wire services, they say, presumptive GOP nominee John McCain wrapped up his fact-finding mission to Iraq today, declaring the trip an unqualified success. My friends, he said, I came to Iraq to hide the facts about the way the war is going, and in that I have succeeded. Mission accomplished. Senator McCain praised his campaign staff for steering clear of visual evidence of recent violence in Baghdad. Thanks to the hard work of my advance team, the surge has the appearance of working. The Arizona senator said that his trip to Iraq was successful in part because he was able to obscure the actual data with new facts of his own creation. And McCain said, it's a well-known fact that Iran is training al-Qaeda, and if it wasn't a well-known fact before, it is now. In a speech commemorating the 5th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, President Bush echoed Senator McCain's fact-finding theme. As far as any war is concerned, the facts speak for themselves, Mr. Bush said, so I won't mention any of them. Mr. Bush acknowledged that the war still presents certain challenges, but concluded on an upbeat note. Iraq today is in better shape than Bear Stearns. Thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, for his tongue-in-cheek look at the news. 866-303-2270, Scott in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm getting there.
Oh, good. I just wanted to respond to a couple things. One was that guy that was talking about the African countries thriving under colonialism.
Yeah, I know.
And I think just one book that people could look at is Adam Hochschild's King Leopold's Ghost, because he...
Oh, yes. That was an absolutely brilliant book.
Yeah,
and he documents that around
2 million people died just in that one, you know, exploitive burst of under the sugar, or not sugar, but rubber production.
Yeah. Well, in another example, this when we were in Sudan, this was a story that one of the aid guys there, John, told me. He said, this is Joe Madison, actually, the African-American talk show host who was with us, who told me this story. He said that in Rwanda, he said, remember when we were kids, the Watusi? And you know, Joe and I are about the same age, you know, we're in our 50s. And I said, yeah, I remember the Watusi. He says, well, the Watusis were the tall people, and they had long, thin faces, and they looked sort of a little more European, a little more French. And the Tutsis, that was the Watusis, and the Hutus were known as pygmies. They were shorter people. They were around 4 feet tall. And so he said, when the French left Rwanda, that what they said was, we're going to give the power to the people who look like us. And so they gave the power to the tall people. And but the shorter people were the majority, and they were the and you know, I was just like, you know, boom, here you go, let's have a disaster, you know. And I'm obviously hyper simplifying what happened in Rwanda, but as was Joe, but there is this legacy of colonialism and now neocolonialism, corporate neocolialism in many
ways. And then if you get into the Cold War and look at the CIA and all the stuff with Patrice Lumumba, et cetera, so you can go on and on. But I have one other thing. I was thinking of this, with this economic meltdown, it seems like the Obama campaign really has a club to beat on the Clintons, because if she's going to claim that she's experienced because of her years at the White House, you know, we can't lay all this off on Ronald Reagan, because we had 8 years of a Democratic administration where we could have undone some of the damage and could have reclaimed some of the New Deal. And we did just the opposite, because the deregulation went on full steam under Clinton, and they really drank the Kool-Aid, too. So,
And not just domestic deregulation, international deregulation through the WTO, the GATT, or the NAFTA, things like that. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think Obama really needs to hit that. And the other thing Obama needs to hit is, if this becomes about race when he is the candidate, he needs to spend a lot more time talking about the constant Southern strategy that the Republicans have used to stir up racial animosity and the gains that they've made since Nixon. So he needs to hammer on those things. So
very,
those are
very
just
well
couple,
said.
Couple things. So thanks a lot, Tom. For
thank
your good
you, Scott.
Work, and talk to you again.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the call. In fact, let me. I was halfway through an Obama clip here when we hit a break in the last segment. Let me just wrap this clip up. Oops. Hang on just a second here. Sometimes my computer goes crazy.
And just as black anger often proved counterproductive, so have these white resentments distracted attention from the real culprits of the middle class squeeze. A corporate culture rife with inside dealing, questionable accounting practices, and short-term greed. A Washington dominated by lobbyists and special interests. Economic policies that favor the few over the many. And yet, to wish away the resentments of white Americans, to label them as misguided or even racist, without recognizing they are grounded in legitimate concerns, this too widens the racial divide and blocks the path to understanding. This is where we are right now. It's a racial stalemate we've been stuck in for years. And contrary to the claims of some of my critics, black and white, I have never been so naive as to believe that we can get beyond our racial divisions in a single election cycle or with a single candidate, particularly... particularly a candidacy as imperfect as my own.
This is just an absolutely extraordinary speech. Joan in Montana. Hey, Joan, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm fine. I'm running on fumes, actually, but I'm fine.
Well, that's what I was listening. That's what I heard. Listen, I wanted to make a comment about the manipulative Bush uses. And, you know.
Joan, your phone is breaking up. In fact, you just vanished, so I'm sorry. It's I know you were at hold there for a while, but it's a tough one using you. When you call in, try not to use a cell phone. It, just in general, let me just put that right across. Harold in Los Angeles. Hey, Harold, welcome to the program.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Yeah, I want to respond to the comment that Steve made. I guess it was your first call regarding colonialism having been good for Africa. It is clearly a preposterous and racist notion. And with people like that going to Africa and supposedly providing aid and assistance, it's a good indication why many of the problems that colonialism caused in Africa persist. I'm of the opinion, I've been to Africa several times, and I've pretty well read on about colonialism in Africa. And it is clear to me that there isn't a problem that Africa has that the removal of white racist multinational corporations, right, exploiting Africa's resources would not solve. There has been this long history of exploitative Europeans going to Africa, causing conflict, pitting various ethnic groups against each other, assassinating and overthrowing Africa's most visionary leaders. One of your callers mentioned Patrice Lumumba, but there have been many others in the past. And I need to correct you on something that you said regarding the situation in Rwanda. It wasn't the French. It was first the Germans and then the Belgians inculcating the Tutsis. With an unofficial a racial identity that aligned them more closely with their European colonial masters.
That's interesting. I confess that I know I've not been to Rwanda and I know very little about it. I was just sharing the story that Joe told me.
Subject would be Mahmoud Madani's book, When Victims Become Killers. He lays it out clearly what happened, because he clearly states that the genocide in Rwanda, for instance, did not begin in 1994, but rather in 1884, and that was immediately following the Berlin West African countries when the European powers got together and decided to split up Africa as it were. And it was the horrors of colonialism that produced the genocidal impulses that we see playing out in Africa today. First, it was the genocidal impulses of the Europeans going into Africa, right? And killing tens of millions, genocides that have not been discussed.
Right, just to get the resources. Harold, we have 30 seconds before we got to take a break. Let me just toss something real quickly. Earlier, I had said that I think we should stop the oil embargo on South Sudan so that they can sell their oil. And I was talking about American oil companies going in there. Looking back on it, I think that was a stupid statement. What I should be saying is the South Sudanese should create their own damn oil company, just like the Arabs are doing, you know, Aramco and things like that, and create their own oil company and like Chavez, you know, and export and sell their own oil, right?
Exactly. One other important point. In Darfur, don't forget about the U.S. and it.
You can finish up.
In Israel, fostering conflict. That there was an early report came out of the BBC and Al Jazeera, clearly indicating the attempt by the United States and Israel to break up Sudan, to balkanize it, so they can control the areas in the south and in the west, like Darfur, to control.
Harold, I think that's a bit of a stretch. I think that's a bit of a stretch. 45 minutes past.
Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome to wherever you are. This is your life. You made it this far. Welcome. You gotta believe that right here, right now.
We have a TV monitor here in the studio, and on CNN they're showing the anti-war protesters in San Francisco, a few people being hauled off. And so I just want to shout out, we're on the air live in San Francisco, of course, every day. Shout out to the good people of San Francisco that are out there protesting this fifth anniversary of this horrible invasion, war, and occupation of Iraq. And, you know, God bless you. Keep up the good work on behalf of our troops, if nothing else, on behalf of all of us. Glenn in San Francisco. Hey, Glenn, speaking of San Francisco.
Tom, I just like to say how moved I was over the weekend listening to the Winter Soldier hearings, you know, sponsored by Iraq Veterans Against the War there in the Washington area. They had like approximately 50 panelists of discharged veterans that talked on such subjects as rules of engagement and racism and so on. But not only didn't the corporate media cover the subject, but apparently MoveOn.org didn't publicize it. And only Representative Lee among the politicians was involved in it. I can only hope that she'll introduce the text in the congressional record.
Yeah, and thank you, Glenn, for pointing that out. In fact, when Laura Flanders filled in for me, she had those folks on our show. So, you know, good on them and good on you for mentioning it. I appreciate it. Let's see here. David in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hey, Tom. I was just reading about a Catholic archbishop that was found in Iraq last week. And Pope Benedict has since come out and, I'm quoting here, made an emotional appeal for an end to violence and massacres in Iraq.
Yeah, well, Pope John Paul II condemned this war before it started.
Yeah,
and after it started.
I'm just wondering, where are the righties talking about how, you know, how they should we should be disenfranchised from the Catholic Church the way Barack Obama has, you know. Not is he unpatriotic for calling it for an end?
Well, you know, the United Methodist Church, which both George Bush and Dick Cheney are members of, the church that I was raised in, has officially condemned the war.
Yeah.
I mean, it's I guess the question isn't should these politicians be distancing themselves from the church, but should perhaps we be listening to what the church is saying? I mean, it's separate from the Obama issue, but this has to do with the Iraq war. But,
and one more comment here, Tom. Last week, President Bush was talking about how romantic it would be if he, you know, if he was a little younger, and I don't know if you heard this comment or not, and how romantic it would be to be on the front line in Afghanistan, you know, fighting for the freedom and democracy over there. Well, maybe when he's done out of office, he can go over there and do that, and Matt Drudge can out him the way he did Prince Harry over in England.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot, David. I mean, and not just, you know, they're taking old guys now. They're taking pretty much anybody now. Oh, my. Gary in Pittsburgh. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Welcome back, Tom.
Pardon me.
That's all right. That's why we love you.
I got this cough button here, and I should have mashed the thing. I'm sorry.
Right. That's why we love you. You have such an honest intellect.
Well, thank you.
I had the good fortune to hear and meet Senator Obama Monday here in Pennsylvania. And just briefly, I'd like to share my observation quickly.
Uh-huh.
I think we have a wonderful opportunity to elect a great man as President of the United States. I see, being 62, I remember John F. Kennedy. I see a little bit of, in my opinion, a little bit of JFK in him, a little bit of Robert Kennedy, and a little bit of Martin Luther King rolled into one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah. And I think he's a marvelous candidate, and that's not to diminish Hillary Clinton. I think that she's a good candidate as well.
One more thing, if I may. Mm-hmm. You used one of my favorite words, statesmanship.
Mm-hmm.
And a long time ago I heard this, and I think it rules the land today. A politician thinks of the next election. A statesman thinks of the next generation. I think that's what Senator Obama will bring us.
Yeah, very well said. Gary, thank you very much. Richard in Queens, New York. Hey, Richard. Richard? No, Richard. Victor in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Victor.
Yes, hi, Tom. I'm a 23-year-old male African-American, and I wanted to ask your opinion as far as the superdelegates go. My question is, if the media is saying that, okay, you know, the popular vote should decide how the superdelegates vote, my question is, what's the sense of having the superdelegates if we're going to go according to, you know, the popular vote?
That's a good question. And I think that
I have a second question after you.
There's really two pieces to this, because the system is not set up that the superdelegates should go with the popular vote. The system is set up that the number of delegates, the maximum number of delegates, is who wins. And I suspect that what's going on is that the Clinton camp is hoping that they can win the popular vote, because they get large numbers of voters in states that hold primaries. And Obama gets large numbers of delegates in states that hold caucuses, where fewer people show up, but they assign the same number of delegates per, you know, per capita on a statewide basis. And so although Obama is ahead right now, and I believe in both popular and the delegate vote, the math that they're doing. And so I think that they're trying to change the goalposts, frankly. And which, you know, you would expect a political campaign to do. But so you had another point.
Yeah, Tom, my second point is the fact that Obama is seems to be winning more from red states, mm-hmm. and Hillary is winning more, you know, blue states. Does that factor into, you know, doesn't logic dictate that, okay, since she's carrying, you know, Democratic states, and Obama won't be able to win Mississippi or, you know, Nebraska in the general election, wouldn't logic say that, okay, she should be the nominee?
Not necessarily. If Obama is winning red states, then he would be a strong candidate against the Republicans. And blue states are going to vote for a Democrat no matter who it is, pretty much. So, you know, as I've said, I think either one of them will make a good nominee and a hell of a candidate. And John McCain, with his blithering and dithering and three mistakes in a row here now, doesn't know the difference between Al-Qaeda and the Shia. It's going to be an interesting election. So, anyhow, I'm going to go off and get some sleep here.
And tomorrow on our program, we're going to have Tara Ross, co-author of Under God, George Washington, The Question of Church and State, and Mike Capuno. And we'll carry on. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.